Okay, perhaps we better make a start. Welcome to the third session. My name is Ben Jackson. I'm based here in Oxford at the Centre for the Study of Social Justice. On the panel this afternoon, we have Julie Bindle, who is the founder of Justice for Women, a feminist organisation that campaigns and supports women who fought back against or killed violent male partners. Julie's also a journalist. She writes regularly for The Guardian and is the editor of The Map of My Life, The Story of Emma Humphreys. Second speaker is John Stoltenberg. John's a writer. His books include The End of Manhood, a book for men of conscience, published in 1994. John is also Andrea Dworkin's partner, and we're very grateful indeed for John to have come across and to share with us his thoughts about Andrea Dworkin's work. We're going to have a slight departure from the format in previous sessions, because unfortunately Julie Bindle has to leave by 4:30. So we're going to take Julie's talk first, then have some questions, and then move on to John's talk in order to give you time to ask Julie some questions. Before I ask the speakers to make their contributions, though, as Claire said at the beginning, Michael Moorcock, the author, was originally scheduled to appear on this panel, but unfortunately couldn't be here. However, he has sent a tribute to Andrea that he wanted us to read out at the session. So I'm going to start off the session by reading out what Michael Moorcock has sent to us, and then I'll ask the speakers to make their contributions. So Michael writes, "Though she has been demonised by her opponents as a man-hating fury, the first word which comes to my mind to describe Andrea Dworkin is charming. She was not only one of the most courteous people I have ever known, she was also one of the most loyal friends. For a man-hater, she certainly had a lot of male friends, including John Stoltenberg, of course, and John Berger, Will Self, Alan Bates, and me. For a fury, she was remembered with considerable affection by all those she had cared so much for, helping them when they were sick, turning up for birthdays and special occasions, celebrating with them, grieving with them. She was a small woman with delicate, sensitive features, tiny hands and feet. She wore dungarees, a leather jacket, and probably had the baddest hair of anyone since Lord Lytton. But she always stayed at the Ritz when she was in London, because experience had shown her that her moxie was admired by people who so frequently had to encounter snobbery and impoliteness from their customers. The staff treated her with the same good manners she offered them. More than once they went out of their way to help her. She was consistently, admirably, always herself. We would eat lunch at the Royal Overseas League. We would go for tea at Fortum's and have dinner at Rule's. And wherever we went together, she was just the same. Utterly, sweetly, sometimes shyly, but always courteously the same. Whether talking in private or speaking on stage, she shone with the truth. People loved her. Andrea was often nervous in public, particularly before an event where she was due to speak. She rarely demanded the help she needed, and because people were often in awe of her, they always thought she had everything under control, so that sometimes they would forget to feed her or arrange transport for her or help her to find a hotel. She never complained. But in her principles, she was uncompromising to the core. She didn't know the meaning of compromise, as she discovered when she and Catherine McKinnon presented their anti-pornography ordinance to the Minneapolis politicians, and the politicians tried to horse trade with her. She held her ground with extraordinary courage, but never with the kind of hard-headed bluster one associates, sadly, with so many of her opponents. Those opponents rarely seemed to include anyone in her female audiences, or sex workers, or the abused. I never knew an occasion in her company when she was not respected by women and men, as if ordinary people instinctively recognised the courage and integrity it took for her to be herself. Only in the press was she frequently insulted, often by people who should have known better, who seemed to reveal their own anxieties, perhaps because they understood unconsciously that she told the truth. Left and right felt threatened by her. Liberals were threatened by her, as they so often are by true radicals. The ACLU was willing to defend the rights of the Ku Klux Klan, but not the basic rights of women harmed by pornography. Hefner described her as the greatest threat to what he stood for, and she probably was. But it took a writer in The Nation to describe her as a Nazi, and newspaper tycoon Conrad Black, only half in jest, said he thought that he had better fire the literary editor who published my review praising her book, Scapegoat. East Coast neocons described her as their most dangerous opponent. The only power she had was her eloquence, her wonderful prose. In recent years, she received less positive attention in the New Statesman than she did in the Conservative press, though she never allied herself with right-wing bigotry, no matter how often its proponents wanted her to, and she continued to identify herself as a person of the left. Her great book, Right-Wing Women, remains one of the best analyses of the right-wing mind I have ever read, and was remarkable in that she had been threatened by such women, yet still managed to remain sensitive to the reasons for what she understood as their compromises. While I agreed with her far more than I ever disagreed, I found her a persuasive and charismatic speaker no matter what she was saying. She totally convinced me, at least while I listened to her. No cause could have had a better publicist or defender. No feminist of our generation has provided us with as many coherent arguments or better analyses of our situation. I believe that her book Intercourse is perhaps one of the most misunderstood and frequently unread texts of modern times. It never surprises me when people who have heard of the book actually read it and admit that they had a completely erroneous impression of its arguments. The most conscientiously truthful person I ever knew, she was the subject of lies which frequently hurt her ability to earn a living. It was possible to believe the notion she always resisted that there was actually a dirty tricks campaign being conducted against her throughout the media. They said she had been prosecuted under Canadian anti-pornography laws she had helped implement. That was a lie. They said she thought all heterosexual sex was rape. Another lie. They said she wanted to shoot all rapists. That was closer to the truth. She knew what rapists stole: identity, self-respect, a person's future. Qualities she valued as much as, if not more than, life itself. For without them, she knew, life was self-loathing, agony or despair. Life requiring huge reserves of courage, just to maintain itself from one day to the next. She knew because she had summoned that courage over and over again since her early experiences of rape and abuse. She knew what abusers stole, and she knew the part pornography played in the abuse of women. She was permanently, eloquently angry about the cruelty women were suffering at every passing moment in every part of the world. This knowledge weighed on her mind. She found consolation in the science fiction novels of Joanna Russ, Octavia Butler, or Connie Willis, in country music, especially the likes of the Dixie Chicks, in the great female singer-songwriters like Joni Mitchell and Janis Ian, in Bessie Smith, Charlie Parker, and in all kinds of classical music. She enjoyed commercial TV series like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Xena the Warrior Princess. And perhaps most of all, she loved good conversation. She could be funny, sardonic, quick. She could talk about everything, and even in disagreement, was always the most coherent of arguers, who never voiced an opinion not based on careful research or consideration. Her arguments were couched in the most logical, courteous terms, and she was always patient, willing to explain her ideas over and over again, to answer familiar criticism as if it was the first time she had encountered it. In recent years, ill health made it hard for Andrea to focus on the book she was writing, in which she looked at some of the great male modernist writers. She was appalled at their anti-Semitism, though not so surprised by their anti-feminism. I found her thoughts on writers like George Eliot and Benjamin Disraeli enormously illuminating. We talked a lot about those two. I tried for ages to persuade her to write a book on Eliot. She was too modest. She felt as an American it wasn't her place. Yet every time we met or talked on the phone, I would raise the notion again, and she would patiently tell me why it wasn't such a good idea. We were lucky in that we had often been in the same place at the same time, by coincidence, and had been able to talk to support one another, but we also talked regularly on the phone. She was very helpful when I was writing what was probably my most difficult book to date. I have never had a better critic, nor a more coherent supporter. I wish I could have helped her more through those painful years when she was having surgery and found it difficult to walk. She used crutches, which she found awkward and frustrating. Her poor balance led to the fall, which was the catalyst for her dying of a previously undiagnosed condition. She had spoken much about death in the last few years, but never morbidly. She loved the apartment she had moved to with John in Washington, but she was tired by her poor health and the simple difficulties of moving from one room to another, let alone from one block to the next. We used to joke about death being a great career move, but she never indicated to me that she ever intended giving up the fight she had begun with the speeches published in Our Blood. She often described her friend and my wife, Linda Steele, as a warrior, but Andrea was the greatest warrior woman I ever knew, both in private and public. A faithful friend, a powerful ally, a natural political leader, and an impressive thinker and writer. Elsewhere, I've described Andrea as the sister I always wanted, and that is exactly how I felt about her. I have lost the best sister I could have hoped for. Her work continues to illuminate and inspire us. Her friendship can never be forgotten, but it will, by those who enjoyed it, always be missed. Michael Moorcock, Texas, April 2006. I'm sure we'll send our thanks to Michael Moorcock for that very, very warm and generous tribute. And now I'll turn over to Julie.